from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio. I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, remembering 9/11, we hear from young adults about their recollections of September 11th, 2001.
Then, we discuss the label, the 9/11 generation.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The U.S. government is investigating unconfirmed but credible threats of terrorist attacks on Washington and New York. The Department of Homeland Security has briefed President Obama about the threats, but has not raised the terror threat level. Intelligence taken from Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan suggested that al-Qaeda would try to attack the U.S. on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Several news agencies are reporting that the terrorists plan to use car bombs. New York City is increasing the number of vehicle checkpoints and police officers available in light of the threat.
The Syrian military continues to aggressively target protesters around the country. In the city of Homs, a major center of opposition, Syrian forces reportedly opened fire against the 2,000 street protesters that had gathered. At least 17 people were killed. The Syrian military also arrested several activists in raids in Latakia, Deir ez-Zor, Daraa, and Hama. As the Syrian crackdown intensifies, international pressure is increasing against President Bashar al-Assad. The European Union announced a decision to ban Syrian oil exports last week, and the United Nations Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, strongly condemned the violence, urging member countries to take action in Syria. According to the UN, more than 2,200 Syrians have been killed since the protests began in mid-March.
Various news organizations are reporting instances of weapons looting in Libya. CNN reported that a stockpile of heat-seeking missiles was missing from a Libyan weapons warehouse. The Associated Press also reported that several sites of weapons storage in Libya are not well guarded and have likely already been subject to looting. In light of these reports, several U.S. officials have expressed concern about the security of Libyan arms. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is urging Libya's new leaders to secure Muammar Gaddafi's cache of weapons. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers says he is actively working with the White House to safeguard loose weapons. Rogers has encouraged President Obama to send U.S. weapons specialists, but the president has promised not to establish an American presence on the ground in Libya. White House officials state that the administration is working with U.S. allies and the Libyan Transitional Council to prevent the illicit trade of Libyan weapons.
The Obama administration is considering a plan to keep about 3,000 U.S. troops in Iraq after December 31st of this year, the most recent deadline for all U.S. troops to leave the country. The remaining American troops would only be responsible for training Iraqi security forces. President Obama had previously pledged to withdraw all U.S. troops by the deadline. Pentagon officials, however, have approached the White House proposing to keep 10,000 or more troops in Iraq after the deadline and have some congressional support. Senators Joe Lieberman, John McCain, and Lindsey Graham released a public statement rejecting the administration's plan. U.S. military officials say that extending U.S. military presence in Iraq past the deadline will require a request from the Iraqi government. So far, no official request has been made.
A pending UN report contains allegations of torture in some Afghan prisons. The report claims that prisoners have been beaten and subject to electric shocks. In response to the allegations, NATO is temporarily suspending its transfers of detainees to Afghan detention facilities. Afghan officials deny the allegations and characterize NATO's decision as politically motivated. They claim NATO is trying to slow the transition of responsibilities from coalition forces to the Afghan government. U.S. and foreign troops are scheduled to completely withdraw from the country by 2014.
NATO and Afghan forces killed al-Qaeda member Sabar Lalmelma, a former Guantanamo detainee, at his home in Jalalabad. Lalmelma returned to Afghanistan in 2007 after a five-year detention in Guantanamo Bay and became involved with al-Qaeda. Lalmelma's case is not unique. According to a Pentagon report in 2009, dozens of detainees have rejoined the front line after the release from Guantanamo.
An American civilian working with the Army Corps of Engineers on the outskirts of Kabul has been killed. Unidentified assailants abducted James Coker from a power plant where he was working and strangled him. His body was later found in a cave. Coker is only the third civilian from the Pentagon killed during the 10 years of war in Afghanistan.
NATO acknowledged that a U.S. soldier mistakenly killed an Afghan reporter working for the BBC this July. Initially, NATO reported that a suicide bomber killed Ahmed Omer Kapulwak, but complaints from the BBC and his family prompted closer investigation, resulting in the new findings. The incident occurred in Oruzgan province during an intense firefight with insurgents. U.S. forces believe Kapulwak was a suicide bomber about to detonate his explosive vest.
This is War News Radio. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. The events of that day left Americans reeling and heralded the beginning of the War on Terror. Now, the young adults who experienced 9/11 as children are being called the 9/11 generation. A team of War News Radio reporters fanned out to speak to these students, and Caroline Batten examined some of the ways the tragedy has affected them.
On September 11, 2001, almost 3,000 people died in a coordinated Al-Qaeda-planned suicide attack on the World Trade Center's Twin Towers in New York City and the Pentagon. A fourth strike was planned for Washington, D.C., but when passengers intervened, the plane crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The attack marked the beginning of a pivotal decade and the start of the longest war in American history. The day was forever seared in Americans' memories, both young and old alike. As we face the 10-year anniversary, the nation is reflecting on the aftermath of the tragedy.
The consequences of our actions are really going to be front and center on the 10th anniversary because, you know, 10 years is a good time to look back and say, what were the implications of this?
That's Elena Reuter, a sophomore at Swarthmore College, a small liberal arts school outside Philadelphia. Reuter is one of the many young adults who witnessed the aftermath of 9/11 at a young age and grew up during what the Bush administration has coined the War on Terror. She and her peers are what a dozen news organizations, as well as President Obama, are calling the 9/11 generation. They say the 9/11 generation appears to be comprised of two groups. One group has become more civic-minded and volunteer-inspired. The other has grown apathetic and cynical watching the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. War News Radio wanted to see whether these young adults agree with the categorization. But first, we heard from them about the role the 9/11 experience played in their childhood. Jesse Cannizzaro, a 21-year-old senior studying theater at Swarthmore, is from New York City. She was in Manhattan on September 11th and shares vivid memories about the day.
It's so engraved in my memory is this just incredibly strong smell of smoke throughout the city. You know, from uptown to downtown, it just, everything smelled completely of smoke. And I just remember walking around the city getting supplies with my parents and just the, like, coat of dust on everything. And just looking downtown and just seeing the smoke and debris and the wreckage that just stayed with the city.
Ross Adair, a 21-year-old senior now studying political science at Swarthmore, was also in New York City. He, too, remembers startling images from the day.
I remember I was walking downtown, and I remember seeing four or five people who were just walking straight up the street, and they were just covered head to toe in ash, and they looked almost kind of like zombies. They sort of had this faraway look on their face. They were obviously in shock, and, you know, at the time I didn't know what was really going on. So I'd never seen anything like that before. And I just thought it was some sort of like weird prank.
Whether or not they were in New York, many students now recall the day as one of shock and confusion. Most of them were in their class at their elementary schools when they got the news, like Becca Spiegel, now a 21-year-old senior majoring in sociology at Colorado College.
I was in sixth grade. I was sitting in my homeroom class, and we had a little TV up in the corner of the room. And, well, it was early in the morning. We'd probably just gotten to school, and all of a sudden my teacher turned on the TV, and we saw footage of the plane crashing into the second tower, and I remember just being totally confused and unable to understand what was going on. It didn't ever occur to me that this was something that was happening, you know, that was calculated and had been planned out. I just couldn't imagine what had gone wrong watching footage of the incident on TV and it's all of its aftermath and being kind of stunned and horrified and unsure what to make of it overall.
Like Spiegel, the majority of the students who spoke with War News Radio felt that the tragedy taught them important lessons, even if they did not at first understand just what was happening. Cannizzaro, in New York, learned how insecure her city was in that moment.
Just the very fact of knowing that my city that, like, for 11 years I thought was just, you know, indestructible, that no one could touch it, and that someone could, like, come in and destroy so much.
Diana Mask, now a senior studying communications at Susquehanna University, had loved ones in the surrounding area and was forced to confront the concepts of loss and tragedy.
My family is originally from North Jersey, and a lot of close family friends were affected by it. We lost a lot of family friends, and just hearing the stories of people whose cars were left at the train station in New Jersey who just went in for the day and never came back, and just hearing the horror stories in general and just trying to understand the emotional stress and duress that these people were going through. You don't have to have an immediate family member who passed away and that to feel like you've lost a relative or it's more of like an American family.
Similarly, Alex Chow, a 21-year-old chemistry major at the University of Delaware, learned about mortality for the first time.
I guess in some ways I've learned about life and death. I know that during that year my grandfather also died, so even at a very young age, at 10, I began to learn about how fragile life can be.
Clinical psychologist Lori Walsh, who was practicing in New York City at the time, explains the effect 9/11 had for most children across the country.
But a lot of kids kind of had their feeling of safety and their feeling of nothing bad kind of will ever happen to me eroded or shaken a little bit. You know, we like to give kids the sense of a firm ground beneath their feet, that they're safe. And in the United States, we've had this luxury of being able to do that for a long, long time. You know, it's a life lesson that we have to give all kids, that people die, that unexplainable things happen.
Dan Kindlin, who teaches child psychology at Harvard University and has written numerous works on the topic of generational trauma, agrees with Walsh, saying that many kids experienced a perspective shift.
Whenever there's a big historical event, you know, in my generation, it was probably the Kennedy assassination, it makes you grow up a little faster than you might have otherwise, you know, and to realize the world isn't quite as safe as you thought it was.
Adair expresses just that.
I think being at that young age and growing up extremely privileged in one of the richest countries in the world, you know, you don't think about that kind of stuff. And, you know, it opened my eyes up to a lot of different things, a lot of different conflicts that I wasn't aware of. And I think it did a lot for a lot of different people. I think sort of an idea that there is another viewpoint. You know, it's something I really had to understand, and I think I'm still understanding.
Chris Kazix, who was 20 years old and just entering the University of Pennsylvania at the time, says that 9/11 was a wake-up call.
I really didn't think about the outside world that much, and then all of a sudden these people came from the other side of the world and crashed into our buildings, so it just kind of opened my eyes. Oh, there's people that have feelings towards the U.S., and I should know more about it.
Like Kazix, Sami Safiullah, a second-generation Bengali now studying anthropology at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, was quickly maturing as a result of the tragedy. He, however, was learning about something even more personal.
At Masjid for my Friday prayers or whatever, we had discussions where they were telling us to, you know, be safe. They were telling us that hate crimes against Muslims had increased, and they were telling us that while we should be
very sad for what had happened during the attacks, we also had to be careful to watch our own backs because now we too were under danger. But I don't really think I knew what that meant, and because I was in elementary school and nobody around me had any idea what was going on either, I was still sheltered enough that it didn't affect me at all.
After the break, War News Radio hears more from students like Safiullah who believe that 9/11 has impacted their lives, delving into the results of 9/11 and the new controversial label of the 9/11 generation. For War News Radio, with Emily Bryant, John McMinn, Rosanna Kim, and Eliana Biscard Church, I'm Caroline Batten.
This is War News Radio. We have seen a broad spectrum of social influences develop from the wake of 9/11, very personal for many and less direct for others. War News Radio's Eliana Biscard Church asks more about the identity of the emerging generation.
The effects of 9/11 are disputed and controversial, but many Americans, including those of the so-called 9/11 generation, see strong impacts and continuing trends.
I think that for most of us, who were in fifth grade, fourth grade, it was a huge wake-up call for us and a huge shock. And from that point on, we became paranoid about terrorism. We became distrustful of other people. We sort of grappled with invading Iraq, and we sort of grappled with tracking down terrorists all around the world. And that has really characterized our adolescence and our teenage years.
After 9/11 came the Afghanistan War, launched on October 7, 2001, the Iraq War, begun on March 20, 2003, and what the Bush administration termed the War on Terror, initially waged against al-Qaeda after the attacks. The FBI has reported that hate crimes against Muslims increased 1,600% from 2000 to 2001 in the United States. And of course, the Big Apple was affected. For Jessie Cannizzaro, now a student at Swarthmore College, who was living with her family in New York City, she found a new sense of community through the tragedy.
It brought the city closer together and instilled like a real sense of pride in what we view as our home and how we protect our home and how we take care of our home. And I think it just really reinforced my view that, like, whether you're talking about New York or Washington or just America in general, like, is home. And no matter where you're from, you have to protect your home.
Meanwhile, with the U.S. engaged in two conflicts abroad, many Americans were sent to fight. Diana Mask, now studying at Susquehanna University, had a loved one deployed as a result.
My brother served in the military, and as a result, he's been sent all over the world and spent 18 months in Iraq. So that in itself had a profound effect because he was over there when I was young still, and I didn't want my brother going away. I didn't want him going somewhere dangerous. I have a huge sense of pride for what he did for our country and the service.
While some have been affected by military deployments, others have seen a different national impact. Alicia Goldberg, an 18-year-old at Sarah Lawrence College, is disturbed by the fear of terrorism she had seen spread throughout her childhood.
We definitely live in this culture of, like, seeing terrorism as an enemy, sort of like we saw the communists as the enemy from the 50s to the 80s, where it was like this big overarching thing and everybody was a communist, now everybody's a terrorist. I'm not as scared of Muslim people the way a lot of other people are. I'm more afraid of the people who are afraid.
Meanwhile, Becca Spiegel, currently studying at Colorado College, sees prevalent discrimination and prejudice against Muslims in the U.S. resulting from this fear of terrorism.
People's attitudes towards mostly Islam come out of that has made me ashamed of that generalization that, like, all Muslims are bad.
Swarthmore Jr.'s Saatchi Hopkins Hayakawa worries that this stereotype of Muslims echoes another historical event in the U.S. that runs close to home for her.
One way that I'm aware of 9/11 and that I'm not sure everyone is that as a Japanese American, it definitely has parallels to Pearl Harbor and the way that Japanese Americans were treated following Pearl Harbor. My grandfather was interned as a college student. He was an American citizen, but of Japanese descent. And so I think the Japanese American community was very aware of the kind of the racial repercussions this could have for the Arab American community. And so they were particularly sensitive to issues like racial profiling at airports.
On the other side of this worry is Sami Safiullah, a student at Vanderbilt and a practicing Muslim. He talks of the difficulty of growing up in a nation so obviously in tension with his religion.
I always thought of myself as an American, and now to suddenly see my identity as an American and my identity as a Muslim come colliding against each other was a very disheartening experience for me. And I think even until today, I still struggle with this identity issue. These days, I'm exhausted. I feel like my presence in society, in American society, is limited by the fact that I'm a Muslim, because I feel like I'm constantly apologizing for 9/11. Isn't that awful? I mean, what kind of society do we live in where people are taught to be defensive, to be apologetic for who they actually are?
Attitudes towards terrorism and Islam were popular subjects among those interviewed, as was the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. Elena Reuter, a sophomore at Swarthmore, believes the war on terror was an inappropriate way to inspire national unity.
I disapprove greatly how we sort of went after it to redeem our pride. You know, you can't do this to us without us, you know, hitting you back three times as hard. And I think that that was the wrong way to rally the nation around coming together and supporting each other.
Ross Adair, a senior at Swarthmore studying political science, sees the concept of terror as inherently abstract. He believes such a war is an impossible mission.
It's fighting just a war that's never going to end. At the time, people were so obsessed with getting revenge and making people know that the United States was still relevant and that we wouldn't be knocked down by this act of aggression. I don't see the war on terror as something that really can ever be won.
Max Bressman, now a senior biology major at Swarthmore, also sees the war on terror as a potentially never-ending war, but is more concerned with the money involved in such a fight.
Now we're in debt and we've been fighting a war way too long and we're getting involved in places we shouldn't get involved in my opinion. And the amount of money that we have to spend and the amount of money that we could be saving on those wars and using to build our own infrastructure, if we could have used, say, half that money, our debt would be significantly lower, and we'd have jobs, we'd have a better ability to take care of our own people.
The children growing up in the wake of 9/11 obviously feel as though the day has impacted their lives, but they do not see it as a defining moment, and the majority reject the 9/11 generation label. Spiegel said she is not comfortable with the categorization.
I feel like it's a strange way to label a generation by a tragic historical event in a nation's history. I know that, like I said, I'm sure I can't ever count the ways that my life has been indirectly influenced by 9/11, but I don't think of myself or my peers as being defined by that event or its aftermath. I'm sure we've learned a lot from it, but so have all of the other generations of people who came before us and were alive to witness that.
Bressman was in agreement.
I think it's a stupid label, and I think that I have no identification with it whatsoever. I don't know anyone who has an identification with it whatsoever. The way I experience it among people who talk about it my age is kind of like, it's more like a historical fact at this point, because so much has happened in the world since then.
And Adair added a final thought.
I think it's changed a lot, but I think that our generation has learned a lot from it, and I think we're gonna be all right. I think we're gonna really be able to handle a lot of different stuff. So we're tough kids.
Child psychologist Dan Kindlin and clinical psychologist Lori Walsh have seen Adair's concept of tough kids play out. Kindlin calls them resilient, and Walsh feels similarly.
Most kids move on, which we often see after a tragedy. And they get sucked back into their kid world, and they worry most about their own worries, you know, what's going on the playground.
So yes, the 9/11 generation has, in a sense, moved on. As told to War News Radio, they undoubtedly see effects of 9/11, yet they choose not to be defined by the event. So what do they think defines them? Reuter has an idea.
I think that there are other things to look forward to. President Obama elected into office as the first African-American president. That's definitely another defining moment. I mean, there's light in the dark. And to define a generation by 9/11, I think, is pessimistic. I think what a more optimistic thing to do would be to focus on all of the, you know, incredible things that happened in our generation. And to remember 9/11 for what it is.
Hopkins Hayakawa also looks to other positives for the generation, including President Obama.
I think there's other things that I identified with Obama's election a lot more as a national event, because I identify with it being something driven by young people and people of color and that sort of thing. And so there's been other events that I felt stronger ties to on a personal level. I certainly feel like I'm a part of a shifting relationship with technology that our generation has and social media.
Many other students mentioned the impact of technology for our generation, but overall, they emphasized their desire to be categorized by something positive. Walsh shares some words of wisdom.
When we have something bad happen, whether it's to an individual person or to, you know, society at large, we have a choice. And you can be viewed as the 9/11 generation and have that be your label, and then have all of the things that you feel and witness and do kind of related to that label. Or we can say, here's a generation of kids, and 9/11 happened to happen when they were alive. And then in that view, yeah, it was a horrible thing, and these poor kids had to have that shatter their childhood innocence. But it doesn't have to mean that every single thing that they go through, every reaction that they have, good and bad, has been related to that event.
And come from 9/11, it will not. With their heightened awareness of the world around them, this generation is sure to be defined in its own terms. For War News Radio, with reporting from Emily Bryant, John McMinn, Rosanna Kim, and Caroline Batten, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Emily Bryant, Kyle Crawford, Amy DiPiero, Jared Nolan, Stuart Russell, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our journalist in residence is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Amandine Lee. Until next time, thanks for listening.